Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker, authors of a new children's book, A is for Art Museum. We'll also drop in on an arts program for preschoolers at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Susan Lewis looks at the Temple Arts and Quality of Life Research Center, where they're working to demonstrate links between the arts and physical well-being. Jason Pfeiffer speaks with members of the Philadelphia Theatre Company and playwright Terence McNally about his latest drama, Unusual Acts of Devotion. And the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns profiles Angela Mead. The Academy of Vocal Arts soprano is already making a big impact on the opera world. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
On a recent Sunday morning, a group of preschoolers has been given a quick lesson in gallery etiquette.
And I just want to tell you one very important rule.
You can't touch anything.
Exactly.
And for many, having their first experience interacting with great art, in this instance, Marc Chagall's 1911 Oil on Canvas, Half Past Three, The Poet.
How many ears does our picture have? Look up high.
One.
Well, only one ear? Can you guys grab your ears? We're lucky we have 2 years, huh?
The woman leading this group of toddlers is Katie Friedland, the museum's manager of family and children's programs, who, along with senior curator of education, Marla Shoemaker, has written A is for Art Museum, a new take on the standard ABC book for preschoolers. The book's aim is to enhance the museum-going experience for the very young and their families, and matched with 26 letters of the alphabet are images from the museum's collections, along with questions to engage children with the works. When I spoke with Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker, I first asked Katie how the idea for this interactive book had come about.
I oversee family programs at the museum, and I would notice that a lot of families would come in and have this wonderful experience with us in the building, but then would ask me if there was anything they could take home to, you know, use again, or people would call and say, I'm going to be coming to the museum next week. Is there anything I can use before I come to introduce my children to the artwork? And I started thinking about that it would be so wonderful if we had a book that families could enjoy and could, you know, prepare them for a visit to the museum and who would help them then continue their learning after they left. So that's where the original thought came. And because at the PMA, our family audience, the largest audience is preschoolers, I knew I wanted to do something that, you know, was for that audience, and the alphabet just seemed like a perfect place to start.
And that was where you started. And what then, Marla, was the process of deciding what artworks would represent each letter?
Given that the museum has 250,000 plus objects, it took a long time to pick the 26 images. And it was a process that involved both Katie and me, but also our wonderful director, Ann Darnancourt, who passed away.
And this may well be the last book.
We are delighted that she played a part. We began by wanting parents and children to know, without saying it, but just by showing it, that museums have all kinds of things inside them, not just paintings. Clothes and furniture and paintings and sculptures and old things and new things and things from other countries and things from today, to really try to represent breadth. You know, my background is I've been at the museum for 35 years, and for 20 of those I was teaching kids every day in the gallery. So I have a lot of experience with what kinds of things capture kids' imaginations at different ages. So finding things that we thought parents and kids could just pore over and talk about all different kinds of things when they looked at them. So it was kind of a long process to pick the 25.
And is there a science? Because I know with preschoolers, they can be either really easy to reach if you get it right, mm-hmm. or completely impossible otherwise. Is there some sort of child psychology, or was there any science behind the images you chose or how you went about it?
Yeah, mainly in the one or two either questions or sentences that we attach to each letter. And that did affect sometimes us deciding to switch out a work of art for another. We wanted to tap into the things kids are good at during the preschool years. Kids are good at moving. So we wanted some suggestions about relating to this work of art physically with your body. My favorite one is for the Modigliani painting, N is for neck. Modigliani is a school of Paris painter from the early 20th century who puts these gorgeous swan-like necks on the woman that he paints. And it's sort of all you ever want to say about Modigliani anyway is neck. And so we asked the children to stretch their neck, and, you know, to, so, and that by stretching the neck, we know, or educational psychologists know, kids notice that long neck more by actually stretching their own neck. So some of the activities have to do with moving their bodies, pose like this dancer, et cetera. We also wanted to use, the other thing preschoolers are really good at is imagining and moving from reality into fantasy really, really smoothly. So we asked them when we have an image for, oh, it's for ostrich, of a carousel figure that's in the shape of an ostrich. And one of the things we say is, you know, where would you ride? Where would you sit? Which is a looking activity. But the last thing is, and what would you say to this ostrich? You know, tapping into that side of them. And then finally, we want them to be more visually acute and to grow their sense of seeing. And so some questions are look and find questions.
I have to confess that with my own two-year-old, Katie, I sat her on my knee and went to read this book, and she wasn't interested first time around. And then she kept going back to it because the subjects are slightly more oblique than they might normally be in an ABC book, Apple Ball. And it was a deeper process that when we were looking for, I think, Z for Zebra, it's amongst a group of a lot of other animals in a painting of Noah's Ark. And the zebras are there in line, and she had to go and find those. Did you purposefully make it less obvious than might be the case with other such books?
Well, I mean, I wanted to make it, you know, I have a toddler at home as well, and I wanted to make a book, Marla and I both felt that we wanted a book that parents and children would enjoy reading together. So I know that my son loves to point out every ball that he sees, but I also know that that is a little tiresome for me over, you know, over time. And so there are certain books that we have in our own personal collection that I feel like I get a lot out of as we read, and therefore we get a lot out of, you know, as a parent-child unit.
You'll have to give me a list later.
I will, definitely. I could definitely do that. But so I think that, you know, I wanted to choose things that I thought would be interesting, that I would want to expose to my child, that I wanted to help, you know, thinking of my own son, things that, you know, that would help him take his, you know, learning experience to the next level. So, yeah, we were trying to choose a little bit more unusual things.
Philadelphia Museum of Art educators Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker, authors of A is for Art Museum, now available on the Temple University Press imprint.
Look up there. What do you see up there?
Flowers.
This is a great picture. I'm so glad that you guys got to look at this picture with me today. Give yourself a big round of applause. Thank you for coming. Good job.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Throughout recorded history, the arts have been evoked to heal pain. Music soothes crying babies, helps teenagers navigate the seas of adolescence, releases tension in adults at the end of the workday, and comforts those in distress or mourning. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis visits the Arts and Quality of Life Research Center at Temple University, where they're making a scientific case that the arts can make a positive difference in people's lives.
A guitar is strumming, not in a practice room or a performance space, but in Shriners Hospital in North Philadelphia. A resource room with the hum of computers and fluorescent lights overhead and the occasional beeping of monitoring machines seeping under the door has been turned into a makeshift recording studio with a guitar, a keyboard synthesizer, and a laptop with a computer program called GarageBand.
If you have just the movement of a thumb and to be able to create a world of sound on the synthesizer is amazing.
Michael Viega is a music therapist who has been working with kids with spinal cord injuries.
Even in the guitar, I may work in the world of sound. So they go, yeah, that's it. And then it turns into something. So I'm just kind of feeding off what they're telling me and trying the best of my ability. My brain has to be in there somewhere, but to the best of my ability, I'm trying to be just a vessel for what they're telling me and be their hands and leave myself out of it completely.
I had just come to Shriners. And I was, like, all icky and sore.
Into the room has come 16-year-old Elena, who has been at Shriners since her car accident during the summer, which left her in a wheelchair with limited mobility.
He's like, what's the one thing on your mind?
Yeah, what's on your mind right now? Or,
and I'm like, pain.
What have you been thinking about?
Pain, lots and lots of pain. Mm-hmm. And so then that's kind of got started.
With Viega's help, Elena has recorded a CD about her pain as part of a songwriting program funded with a grant from the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation.
Take my mind away. Take my mind away. Take my mind away. Off of this pain.
Although for For centuries, people have intuitively turned to the arts in times of trouble. Art and music therapy emerged as distinct healing fields in the last 60-some years. In the 1940s, art and music caused noted improvements in the well-being of veterans returning from World War II. In 1944, the first music therapy degree program began at Michigan State University. The American Music Therapy Association was founded in 1998. When Robert Stroker came to Temple as dean of the Boyer School of Music and Dance, he was inspired by the combination of resources already in place, a music therapy program, a medical school, and a hospital.
And I thought it was a great opportunity to create a unique interdisciplinary program that really hasn't been, and a research program that hasn't existed anywhere, to create opportunities for others. And really the bottom line is to find a way for the arts to serve the general public, to help improve the quality of life and the well-being of others.
And so was born Temple's Art and Quality of Life Research Center, which not only does art and music therapy, it works to scientifically prove that the arts, both in therapy and non-therapy settings, can make a positive difference in people's lives. The center's director is music therapy professor Cheryl Dillio. She says just how much the arts affect us is vastly underestimated.
Psychologically, physiologically, socially, developmentally, cognitively, and spiritually. And our purpose is to investigate the outcome of the arts in these areas where we don't have a great deal of research.
For example, when a hospital patient is exposed to the arts, a variety of specific quantitative measurements can be taken.
Heart rate, blood pressure. We'll look at such outcomes as anxiety reduction, mood enhancement, pain reduction. These are all scientific measures where we can demonstrate fairly clearly that music or the arts have an effect on individuals who have medical difficulties.
Qualitative research can be culled through interviews and observation. The center's assistant director, music therapist Yoga Brott, says, for example, after children finish the songwriting program at Shriners, they're asked questions in open-ended interviews.
Such as, what did this program do for you? What did you learn about yourself through the songwriting? We ask them what they liked the most about it, what they didn't like about it. So it's more an evaluation of the program rather than somebody else telling us what they think the child learned from this. And hopefully as the program continues, we can include some more quantitative measures as well.
Quantitative studies, in particular, says Brott, encourage increased funding for more programs and more studies, which encourage more funding. Robert Stroker says the research component also helps convert those who are skeptical.
In the past, the people in the medical field have been separate from people in the education field and the arts. But what we're finding is when people really sit down and take a look at the true outcome measures of this program, they're coming on board.
In addition to documenting its own studies, the center is pulling together research done all over the world that examines the effects of the arts in various settings, preparing reviews for the Cochrane Library, an international database for professionals and lay people seeking information about the effects of particular drugs or treatments. The center is also developing a training program for artists and is working to educate healthcare professionals about the ways the arts can be part of programs of integrated care.
We're developing an online continuing medical education course for nurses and doctors and student nurses and doctors that will help them understand the outcomes and potential benefits of music in hospitals.
Aside from using the arts in medical facilities, the center is also investigating and developing culturally specific programs for use in community settings. One music program focuses on Latino women at risk for heart disease. Another idea percolating is to target caregivers for Alzheimer's patients. People in difficulties, says Dillio, need to tell their stories.
The strength and the integrity that they've derived from this process also helps them to find options in other parts of their lives.
They're working through such heavy issues, identity, control of their environment, control of themselves.
Michael Viegas says the hard work in the creative process of songwriting challenges the kids to move forward.
You have to begin to find your voice, which is really a deep metaphor for finding this new life and how am I going to find my new voice in light of this. Wanting to get back to a quote-unquote normal life.
was pretty fun. I had a lot of fun doing it. I was kind of embarrassed, like, when we actually started the singing, I was like, no, you guys can't be in here. I was still iffy about Mike being here at all, but I got over it.
We know the arts touch us, often in ways we can't describe. Temple University's Arts and Quality of Life Research Center is trying to do just that. Its publications include articles about the effects of the arts in cancer, heart, and brain injury patients, and the arts' value in symptom relief and end-of-life care. Project by project, study by study, the center explores new ways to use one of the oldest endeavors, the arts, to improve the human condition.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Philadelphia Theater Company opened its season this week with a new play by Terrence McNally. The four-time Tony Award winner has been a prolific writer over the past 50 years of plays, movies, musicals, and even opera librettos. With his latest work, McNally continues a 20-year relationship with the Philadelphia Theatre Company, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the premiering play takes an unblinking look at city living.
Since the late 80s, McNally has seen six of his plays produced by the Philadelphia Theatre Company, including three premieres, Masterclass, Some Men, and now Unusual Acts of Devotion. This play was actually slated to premiere in Philadelphia last season, but was shelved for a year after the leading actor, Kathy Bates, backed out of the project. McNally says the play has been 2 years in the making, with inspiration from a view outside his apartment window in New York City.
Not of the skyline of New York, but of people several floors below me who use the roof of their building, apartment house, as a outdoor living room in the summer. And they have meals there almost every night, music, and sometimes they're dancing, and sort of imagining that life with the cityscape all around. And that was probably where the play started.
Set on the rooftop of a Greenwich Village apartment building, the story unfolds as Leo, a jazz musician and New York native, and his wife Nadine celebrate their fifth wedding anniversary. They're joined for dinner by three neighbors, Mrs. Darnell, an elderly original tenant of the building, Josie, a schoolteacher, and Chick, a city tour line guide. Throughout the course of the evening, Josie, played by Faith Prince, reconnects with Chick, played by Richard Thomas.
If you're going to drink the stuff, you should at least learn how to open it.
Well, I'm used to having it opened for me.
A boyfriend?
A bartender. I think I'm a little long of the tooth for a boyfriend. We both are.
She hastened to add.
What about you?
No.
No one?
Aaron was the last cookie on my plate.
Oh, we don't know that.
Yes, we do. Here.
According to Terrence McNally, Unusual Acts of Devotion is in many ways about community, the human need for relationships. The Texas native says it examines themes of loneliness, aging, and the experience of living in the city that never sleeps.
New York City is a character in this play. It's kind of New York at night. I mean, these people are informed by the sea of buildings around them and the humanity in those buildings. And so it sort of reflects my appreciation and wonder and the experience of being part of a huge community. So it's not a rural play at all. It's very much a big city play.
A play that McNally says could have been set in Philadelphia, but not just in any locale in a city like Philadelphia or New York. Richard Thomas, best known for playing John Boy in the 1970s TV series The Waltons, see symbolism in the setting of the play atop an apartment building.
The roof is a magical place in an urban area because it releases you from the confines of the apartment and it gets you off the street. So there's a feeling, I think, maybe on the roof, in this play anyway, by extension, of freedom and liberation, that people can somehow release things, let things go into the air and be freer on the roof.
With Unusual Acts of Devotion, Thomas performs in his fourth McNally play. He says most of the playwright's works are character-driven, not consumed by overly complicated plots, but rather exploring the inner recesses of the individuals in the story. And, Thomas notes, most McNally plays have a sober view of the world.
He's a humanist. You know, he's not a sentimentalist about the human condition. All of his characters are flawed. So it's not Never Never Land. It's really the world in which we live, and it's very difficult. But he has an abiding faith in the possibilities of relationship and humanity, even in his tragedies.
Thomas says McNally plays are also wickedly funny, something commonly noted about the writer's work. Faith Prince, a Tony Award-winning actor who's now in her fourth McNally project, says the combination of humor and tragedy is what makes his work so effective.
People that can write like that, that's fascinating to me. That's my, probably the form that I like the best in anything, musical, straight, is the pathos and the comic within it. Because I think that's the way real life is. I think at the most tragic moments, there are funny things, and vice versa. And all his characters are full that way.
Citing the influence of master playwrights like Anton Chekhov and Shakespeare, McNally says this balance between humor and sadness is something he consciously strives for.
Because I think life, you know, I really don't think we're prepared for bad news. And we can be living very much in the moment, very fully and very happily. I don't think life has great transitions in it. You know, I think you get hit by the bus because you're looking the other way and you don't have 45 minutes to get ready. Oh, here comes that bus. It's unexpected. And I try to reflect that very quick turn of events.
McNally, who's nearly 70 years old, says while it's too soon to evaluate how Unusual Acts of Devotion thematically fits into his larger body of work, the play seems to mark new territory for him.
I suspect, but I can't prove it, but just a gut feeling is this is maybe the beginning of a final act in my work, because at my age, I'm obviously not going to be doing this forever. But this seems like a departure in themes. It seems a gentler play than some of my earlier work.
McNally says he's still developing opinions about his latest play, along with all those who will see it for the first time over the next month.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Unusual Acts of Devotion runs at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia through November 23rd. Philadelphia has been the birthplace of many great opera careers, but few sopranos even dream of singing the great Bellini aria Costa Diva, as well as Angela Meade. Meade is currently in her fourth and final year at the Academy of Vocal Arts and on the roster of the prestigious Astral Artistic Services. Already, Meade made a last-minute Metropolitan Opera debut last year in Verdi's Hernani. Yet, as the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports, a greater vocal challenge comes next Saturday when she portrays the doomed wife of Henry VIII in the title role of Donizetti's Anna Bolena.
Just because Angela Meade has sung at the Metropolitan Opera, and more importantly, has been re-engaged for future seasons, doesn't mean AVA's music director Christopher Makatsouris is going easy on her during rehearsals for Anna Bolena. This is the toughest assignment of her nascent career, but is she intimidated? Hardly. The mark of a fledgling diva isn't necessarily temperament or imperiousness, but a good work ethic plus a strange, almost practicality-defying immunity to circumstances from which others would shrink. She's almost casual about hitting the notes. She's a little worried about the complexity of her character.
There's such raw emotion in it, and sometimes I get so involved in the emotion that I feel like I'm screaming rather than singing. So it'll be a really good lesson for me to be able to do this here and really work it into myself. Because I had studied that actually when I was an undergrad. One of my teachers gave it to me. And I just kind of put it on the back burner and sort of learned it, but never sang it or anything. And I figure, you know, with enough time and study that sort of anything's possible, I guess. So I didn't ever think that, oh my God, what did I do? No. It's come fairly easily.
Bel canto opera, that often neglected, vocally florid early 19th century art form, requires singers to be at an athletic peak while giving full-blooded characterizations of monarchs, druids, famous murderers, even though the score only gives the formulaic outlines. The beauty of AVA is having time to work in ways not always available in the operatic treadmills of the world, where the tough but needed guidance of Maestro Makatsouris isn't always available.
It's a great trial for her, in a sense, to try it out here in a controlled environment, to learn a role like this where we can discuss every dot and dash and why and correct the diction. And since we work so often together, that is a good, healthy work habit.
This world could hardly be further away from small-town Centralia, Washington, midway between Portland and Seattle, where she grew up excelling in music but playing flute and bass clarinet. When she discovered her voice and decided to develop it at USC in Los Angeles, her parents weren't pleased. How could they be in a town of 15,000 people that knew no opera and where the idea of making a living singing it couldn't be more alien?
My parents are very proud, but they didn't want me to do it for a long time. They liked me singing and everything. My dad's just very analytical. He's a scientist of sorts. I mean, he's a research forester, but he, like, you know, figures out how to approach trees faster and things like that. So he's very, you should have a steady job and a steady income, and you should be able to take care of yourself and, you know, everything, yada, yada, yada. So he doesn't understand the whole artistic mindset. So it was hard to persuade them for a while. But they're totally on board now.
When starting her doctorate in L.A., she auditioned at AVA and, to her surprise, was accepted. Yet trouble was brewing in her throat. Most singers have some sort of false start before they decisively find their own voice, and Mead was no exception. A bad choice of roles in L.A., that of Mother Goose in The Rake's Progress, combined with a strange reaction to ibuprofen and a particularly loud cast party, put her voice on a downward spiral. That wasn't reversed until arriving in Philadelphia, where she vocally retooled. It was then that Mead saw just how much music meant to her.
Well, it made me realize that I really wanted to do this, because I feel like it's part of me, and I feel like I wouldn't be whole without it. It would be like I would be a different person if I weren't doing this. Does that make sense? Who would I be?
Only then did Angela Mead discover how to sing the kind of pianissimos that make audiences melt. She went on to win 50 competitions, from the Jose Iturbe Foundation to the Metropolitan Opera National Council. The prize money helped defray educational expenses. Then, on one day's notice, she was asked to sing Verdi's Ernani at the Met.
I wasn't nervous until my dresser got up and left me. And I was sitting there by myself, and I'm looking at the back of the curtain going, "Dear Jesus, I'm singing at the Met."
Anna Bolena is, even by bel canto standards, a win big or lose everything kind of role. It can have Shakespearean magnitude, though only a handful of singers have succeeded with it. Their names include Maria Callas, Joan Sutherland, and Beverly Sills. But does Maestro Makatsouris think Angela Mead is ready?
Well, look, no one's really ever totally ready. So we always have to go out and risk a little bit. That's half the fun and half the, I don't know, the excitement about. If you have enough technique and you know what you're doing, Angela's a very good singer. There's no question about it. She has it.
More likely, what will get her through is the attitude that won her so many contests.
I'm sort of a non-pressure sort of person. I walked in, I was like, if I sing and they like me, fantastic. If I didn't, goodbye.
And that is a very good definition of a diva.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Angela Mead in Tuesday's paper. Mead sings performances of Anna Bolena on November 8th, 11th, 20th, and 22nd at the Academy of Vocal Arts. She'll also sing Lucia de Lammermoor there later this season. This spring, she sings Strauss's Four Last Songs with Symphony in C. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.